make sure you have enough money when you start because it's expensive and you always have to grow, which means you always have to throw more money into it. It's a never-ending process. And make sure you love it. Make sure you really are enjoying what you're doing. You're not in it just to make money, but you're doing it because it fulfills some passion of yours and it gives you joy.
From the American Craft Spirits Association and Craft Spirits Magazine, this is the Craft Spirits Podcast. I'm John Page, and today on the program, we're joined by Lucy Farber, the operations manager for St. George Spirits in Alameda, California. Lucy is also a board member for the American Craft Spirits Association and one of the tri-chairs for our education committee. In March, Lucy chatted with me about her early days at the distillery, being a part of a reinvention when ownership transitioned from founder Jörg Rupf to Lance Winters, some of her biggest challenges throughout the years, her decision to run for ACSA's board, and her passion for education. In a way, her road to the spirits world started on a tennis court.
Well, the job did start with tennis, but I knew Jörg and Ladine for decades before that. I met Jörg and Ladine. Ladine is Jörg Group's wife at the time. In the early 80s, when Jörg had just started the distillery, because he was sharing the distillery, a shack at the time, with a couple of wineries. They were in an industrial area next to some train tracks in Emeryville, which later got paved over to become a parking lot for a biotech company. And that's how Jörg ended up at Alameda. But that's how we met. My husband and I met Jörg and Ladine, and we became friends and tennis partners over the years. And Ladine and I played tennis regularly. She was also my younger son's piano teacher. So we knew them a long time. And at a certain point, my older son was going off to college, and I was doing financial aid forms. And my husband and I had a small press publishing company at the time, doing very niche, arcane, unwanted experimental literature, which was very common to what Jörg was doing with his eau de vie that nobody wanted. It was, you know, the 80s and 90s when people wanted salad and Chardonnay, and Jörg was making these weird 40% alcohol fruit brandies that weren't sweet. And so there was a lot in common in this funny way between the two businesses, between trying to sell poetry in William Burroughs and trying to sell eau de vie and kiwi champagne. Then Jörg and Lance started with Hangar One. And Hangar One, the vodka started to take off. And suddenly, Jörg's business went from being really just sort of fun craft business to actually having to be a business, and he was feeling overwhelmed. And Ladine, during our tennis matches, would always tell me about what was going on with Hangar One, and I was really interested. And then at one point, when I realized that I didn't have enough money to pay for her piano lessons or all the other music lessons and everything else, and I was complaining to Ladine, she said, "You should go see Jörg. He really could use some help. You know, things are getting overwhelming." So I went to see Jörg the next day and Lance, and I started full time the following week, and I stopped playing tennis with Ladine, and I didn't play again for 17 years.
Oh, wow.
But at the time, they were just moving into the hangar we're in now, the 65,000 square foot hangar. It was a total mess. It had been some kind of equipment manufacturing place. And before that, they had made fighter jets in it. So it was not really set up to be a distillery. And when I arrived there, there were jackhammers going. There was no tasting room. Everything was being built. And it was just Jörg and Lance and one other person named Luis Cruz, who was our warehouse person and helped doing anything that needed to be done. helped with the stills, that kind of thing. So it was just four of us. And the reason it could be just four of us was because the marketing and sales for Hangar One was actually handled by a partner company called Alambic, which was run by Ansley Cole at the time. And so we didn't have to deal with the salespeople, and we didn't have to deal with the marketing. We did all the production, and we did all the shipping, and we did all the compliance, but we didn't have to do the sales and marketing. So that's why you could have four people to run a 65,000 square foot warehouse creating Hangar One.
As opposed to now, how many employees are at St. George?
Well, I think we have, now we no longer have this relationship with Ansley Cole, because that when we sold the brand Hangar One back in 2011, we terminated that relationship and took on everything ourselves. So now there are about 30 employees. It changes every day.
Okay.
People come and go.
And in those early days, how much, I mean, you wouldn't have really been able to do too much tasting, or am I misremembering how the laws worked?
Okay. Well, when I started, we were building a tasting room, and we did start with a tasting room, and we did do tastings, but we weren't actually, it turns out, allowed to charge for the tastings, which we tried to sort of get around that by saying we were charging for the tours and you happen to have a tasting at the end of the tour. But at a certain point, the California ABC came and said, no, you can't do this. And that was sort of our first real foray into changing California laws, because we did get involved with starting a guild. We had tried before, but this was another effort to get a guild together. And we did get a bill passed to allow all distillers to have a tasting room. There was no craft distiller law at that point. I mean, we were always allowed to have a tasting room, but we weren't allowed to charge for the tastings. And so we did get that change, because it was, you just couldn't run a tasting room and pay for your employees without charging something
right, for
the experience. And you couldn't sell anything at that time. You could not sell directly to consumers.
Yeah, you all had a thing for a while where, like, there was a shop in the distillery, but you guys didn't run it, right?
This is correct. There was a what they call a Type 21 licensee, but that was actually owned by Ansley Cole, and I still don't know quite how that happened and how he could do that, because he was a wholesaler and then he had a store, and he also had a distillery somehow. That was allowed in California at that time, and I've never been clear why.
Yeah.
But it was his store, and then later on, when we terminated that relationship, there was a new owner of the store that took over. We would send our products would be ordered by the wholesaler, it would be shipped 50 miles away, and then the store would order it and it would come back.
Yeah.
So, and it was really frustrating whenever they would run low in the store on something, and you could see that there were, you know, thousands of cases
right
20 feet away, but they couldn't have it.
Yeah. It's like these bottles have to go on a field trip and come back. Yeah.
Right. So again, later on, we were instrumental in helping create the craft distillers law and you know, make it so there was such a license for a craft distiller that allowed a certain number of bottles to be sold directly per person per day on site. Unfortunately, when we first helped write this bill, we didn't proofread closely enough, and there was like a comma left out, and because of the comma, it didn't apply. We didn't qualify to be a craft distiller the first year. And then we had to go back and get the language fixed a little bit so that we could qualify.
Okay. Yeah. I'm curious to know, you know, when I guess two things. When you started, like what the main things were that you were doing, but also at the time, you know, was craft spirits, like what did you refer to St. George as if you met somebody like on a bus or a plane and you were describing to them like who you worked for? Did you say I worked for a craft distillery, or did you say I worked for a distillery? Just kind of curious about that.
That's a good question. I think I called it a craft distillery. I think so. Yeah, I think we did. But, you know, when I started, I think there were 10 craft distillers in the country. There were a couple of brandy manufacturers in California. And then, you know, Jorg was the first craft distillery. He was the first one to start because he saw that the law had changed to allow a small distillery to actually exist, because it wasn't economical before when you had to pay a treasury officer to be on site every day to unlock and lock the stills, and you had to pay their salary, and they got to sit there all day while you did nothing. So anyway, I think we called it craft distillers. We, St. George Spirits hosted the very first ADI conferences. They hosted one just before I started working there when they were in a smaller space in Alameda. And I think there were 10 people there. I mean, it was really, really tiny. And then we had a couple more at our hangar. And they, most of the people who were there were people who were thinking about becoming distillers, but weren't distillers yet. So it's kind of been astonishing to watch how the whole industry has exploded since I started, because there really were so few of us, and a lot of them Jorg had trained, because he was instrumental in going out and teaching people. Like, he went up to Oregon and he taught Steve McCarthy about distilling, and he went to the Hudson Valley and he taught people there, and then he taught Chris Berglund about distilling, who started the program at Michigan State. So that was part of his mission at the time, was to sort of build the industry, because he realized that the American public had no idea what he was doing. And so he thought it would be helpful if there were more of us out there. So spreading the word about, you know, what craft spirits could be, or artisan spirits, or just odd things that weren't bourbon or weren't vodka.
Yeah. And then, so the beginning part of that question, I guess, how has your role shifted at all, you know, over the years? Like, what did you tell people on that plane conversation back then versus now?
Well, I think when I first arrived, since there were only four of us, Lance and Jorg looked at me and said, "Well, what title do you want?" And I looked at them and said, "I don't know. I mean, I guess office manager." So I was office manager for a number of years. And then at some point I was like, for the first 4 years, I had nobody else doing any admin work. We had a bookkeeper, but I did all the administrative work, and I did all the purchasing. I still do all the purchasing. And I did all the compliance, and I answered the phones, and I greeted the tradespeople, and I, you know, did all the emails. But when we launched Absinthe, it got to be so crazy that I could not handle all that stuff anymore. Just before the Absinthe came out, the phone would ring, I'd pick it up, I'd put it down, there would be 10 messages, and I couldn't keep up with it. We had, you know, it was like just thousands of emails, thousands of phone calls, and I was like, I have to have somebody in this office, I can't do this.
What was kind of like give us like a flavor of what some of those, you know, emails and calls were about? Was it like just people like trying to figure out where they could get it?
Well, we were the very first American producer of Absinthe. And so it was this big deal that we were going to bring it out. And there were all these people who had heard about it for, you know, historically, and they were extremely excited. I think most of them thought they were all going to be getting some strange drug that was going to give them hallucinations. And there was just this incredible air of excitement about it. The day we released it, there was a line 4 blocks long. We sold out of our production in 6 hours. We had news helicopters overhead. Fox News was there. The Chicago Tribune was there. The New York Times was there. I mean, it was insane. It was really insane. People didn't know what to expect with absinthe. It was just sort of this incredible new thing. And it had nothing to do with what it really was. But it was just,
right.
I guess it was, you know, like, it wasn't quite like, you know, the new iPhone coming out, but it was pretty wild.
Close, though, it sounds like.
It was
So, all right, so that leads to the end of your answering the phone days.
Yeah. So, yeah, I stopped having to answer the phone. Then I also, we started having way too much shipping and everything else, and I got another assistant. So I ended up with a couple of assistants. And I changed my title. Now I'm operations manager. I probably should have a better title, but we weren't really into titles. I was the only person in the distillery, St. George, that had a straight business card title. You know, like, I think Lance was evil genius,
yeah.
Or rocket scientist.
Right.
And I forget what Dave was, but you know, it was like, nobody would have one that just said operations manager, but I thought somebody had to have one for those vendors that you saw at a trade show or whatever.
Yeah.
Now we're a little bit more corporate. And so I feel like I should be like senior VP of something or other, but I'm still operations manager.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and so you say you're a little bit more corporate, but you are still, you know, you're still craft. You know, what was it like seeing the transition? And I guess between, you know, this is Jorg's company to now this is Lance Winter's company.
It was very interesting. I mean, what happened is that when the brand Hangar One was sold, Jorg retired and he passed the company along to Lance, and we terminated the relationship with Ansley, which meant in many ways we were a startup company that had been around for 20 years. And we had to sort of start all over again. We had to hire our own sales team. We didn't have our own sales team. We had a non-compete with Proximo that had bought Hangar One. And so we couldn't make vodka, which was our main source of income. So we had to, that's when we started bringing out the gins. And we did have the absinthe, we had the gins. But Lance really sort of stepped up. He put his money into the company that he had gotten from the sale. He put himself on the line to keep us all there and keep us going. And we've sort of flourished from there. And yeah, it did become much more Lance's vision at that point. And now he's stepping back a little bit, because he's brought on a new CEO. We have a new CEO named Scott Schiller, who you probably know.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of changing things again, too. Scott's bringing in a lot of his team to do things. And he has big plans for us, but we'll see what happens.
Oh, well, tell us all about them, Lucy.
Oh, well, I can't tell you all about them. I'm not supposed to tell you.
Okay. Well,
I mostly it's like, you know, just he wants to make sure more people know about us, because St. George Spirits has been going along all these years, and we believe really strongly in what we do and the quality of what we do, and we don't release anything that we don't 100% believe in. But we've never really been super big on like going out there and advertising this to people and pushing it, making sure that people who don't know us already in our own community know about us. And I think Scott is going to help us with that, sort of spread the word more, not change St. George, but just let more people know about us.
Gotcha. Yeah. That's good to hear. I should also note that we'll put in our little like show notes some stories that we've done on just kind of that basically that conversation of Jorg to Lance and the gins, and probably most people that are listening to this have tried those gins, but for those that have not, the terroir gin and the botanivore and the rye are just beautiful, and they're kind of what brought me started getting me excited about craft spirits, because I lived in Alameda for a few years. Like I went to the tasting room once, but at the time I was a really big craft beer person. I was working for a beer magazine, but just like slowly those gins became like, if I was going camping, I was always taking gin in a flask with me. And then we moved away, and now I'm in North Carolina, and I randomly one day walk into the ABC store and all your stuff, not all your stuff is there, but the terroir gin is there. And I'm like, yes, I need like six bottles of this, just in case it doesn't come back.
Wow. I didn't know it was there. I mean, we ship to North Carolina all the time, but I thought it was all special orders.
there's a good AB, a really good ABC store here that, does it right. I guess that, I mean, that's kind of a good place to transition to just overall Spirits Alley, which is in Alameda. You know, you're on this like former naval base. What was it like going there, I guess, like in those early days? Like, was it basically like going, you know, like through a deserted town? Because like at the time, weren't
it
you
is.
All the other ones there?
It's a ghost town out there, and it still is half of a ghost town.
Yeah.
they were building a huge housing development that was between the tunnel and the base when I started there. And they started putting in roads, and there was nothing around the roads at all. And it was like, what? Why are they making this giant intersection? What is this for? And of course, now 18 years later, there's a Target there or Safeway or whatever, but it wasn't there then. But the buildings, they still haven't done anything with half the buildings at the base. I mean, it's so derelict. Yesterday or whatever, I was watching some teenagers trying to break in across the street to the abandoned building. So it's a very strange collection of things. There are some brand new developers. There is a whole new condo. I don't know if you've seen it. There are a bunch of condos now out there. A new ferry plaza. So they're working on it. But you know, when I first started there, it had been decommissioned maybe 10 years before. And one developer after another kept dropping out. They always had big plans, but it's just now I've been there almost 19 years and they're still working on stuff. With Spirits Alley, you were asking about Jorg when he chose this hangar to move to. He took Lance over there. The place was a complete wreck. I mean, it's just this big, giant hangar with a bunch of broken concrete inside of it. And Lance thought he was nuts that Jorg wanted to move in there. But they took the leap, and then a bunch of people followed after us. So after we started our St. George there, then Rockwall Winery moved in down the street, and they did a lot of events, and they were hosting, and then another winery moved in, and then another winery, and then Faction Brewery moved in next door. And then Hangar One,
right.
Proximo, decided to move in right next door to us. So there was a lot there. And then the city decided to try to they make something out of it. They called it Spirits Alley. But unfortunately now, since the pandemic, a lot of that has actually fallen by the wayside. Rock Wall is no more. Hangar One closed. And the wineries are sort of struggling along. Faction's doing great.
Faction's another, they showed up here at a local bar, and I had to go taste some of that. So like I saw, a headline a couple of months ago, I guess, after Hangar One closed, like, and I'm not paying for the Chronicle anymore, so I didn't actually click through to read it. But, you know, it was like, what's going on with Spirits Alley? So like, what is Admirals there too, and Almanac? Like, it's still yeah. something, right? Tell me it's still
yeah
something.
Well, they're around the corner. Well, yeah. The other thing is St. George Spirits closed to the public in March 2020, and we have not reopened yet.
Okay.
But we do plan to reopen. We just don't know when, but they're working on it. And I think that once St. George is up and running again with tours and tastings and sales and events, I know we're going to be hosting a craft fair there like next month, I think, or sometime soon. So I think things will change, and we'll probably we'll be in the vanguard again and bring back life to Spirits Alley.
Okay, that's what I want to hear. That's good.
Yeah, and maybe one day we'll have a restaurant on site.
Keep talking. Really?
We've got one of the best views in the Bay Area, so.
Yeah, so that is a huge thing. Just driving up to any of those places, to like, you know, the driving between your spot and Faction, and just like looking past the chain link fence there, it's one of the best places to be at sunset, especially because you can see the Bay Bridge and like the skyline in the distance, and it's just beautiful.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And the craft distiller's bill allows you to have a restaurant, and you can and you can take your spirits right from your warehouse for your cocktails. So it would be a great thing. But we don't do anything unless it is great. And so there's not gonna, if we put in a restaurant, it's gonna be a great restaurant.
No, I hear you. If you do that, I'm gonna come visit like the first week.
Exactly. It will be something special.
Yeah.
That's the St. George way. We don't do anything unless it's special.
What haven't we talked about that you would want someone about St. George?
You wanted to know about some of the weird things that I've done.
Yeah.
Working for St. George. So I was thinking about some of the ones that I've enjoyed the most in my time. I mean, the one reason I have liked working there is it's never been boring, especially working for Lance or York, because they always ask me to do something crazy. So at one point, Lance decided he wanted to make rum, but he wanted to make rum from fresh sugar cane. Well, finding fresh sugar cane in California is not an easy task, because we don't have the climate. And it turned out, I had to do some research. It turned out you couldn't import it from out of state because of the California State Department of Agriculture's rules. You had to either have fumigated sugarcane or steamed sugarcane. You know, it had pasteurized. You couldn't get the fresh stuff. So we had to figure out where to find it. I reached out to UC Davis's specialty crop department, which is one of the interesting departments in California too, that's really built up all the strange fruits and vegetables you can find in California. And they put us in touch with some Hmong farmers in Fresno who were growing sugarcane for their tribal rituals and celebrations.
Okay.
And also selling it in 5-pound boxes at farmers markets. So they sent Lance down there to meet with the tribal elders and talk about buying their sugarcane. And we did make an arrangement, but they they were used to these 5-pound boxes of sugar cane, and we needed 40,000 pounds. So I had to send all of these field bins down to them. We had to find a sort of a shed where they could all gather. And all these Hmong farmers came with, they each had like 1-acre plots, and they brought their sugar cane to the shed. And then we spent all, they spent all day loading it into these bins to ship up to us. And we did get it. Unfortunately, the sugar cane was something called elephant cane, which is incredibly big. And the sugar cane mill that I also had been tasked to get and had purchased from an auto parts manufacturer in India and had been sent by ship in a like Pirates of the Caribbean wooden crate. It couldn't process these giant sugarcane stalks. And so we had all the production team with machetes slicing the stalks and trying to get them small enough. And then everybody in the distillery got to feed the sugarcane into the sugarcane mill, including me. But
well, I would hope so. Yeah, after all that.
And then I had to figure out what to do with, after you shred sugarcane or press it, you have something called bagasse, and you have to get rid of it. So that was another task. Hey, what do I do with this? You know, so I always have liked the challenges of that. But we decided we couldn't keep working with the Hmong farmers, and we needed to find something better. So I ended up talking to a sugar scientist in Louisiana who put me in touch with a guy in Brawley, which is down near the Salton Sea, who was growing sugar cane for biofuel research. And he had no use for it. He would grow it and then he would just cut it down and leave it. So we started working with him, but we had to figure out how to get it to us. So I got to learn about what a open top truck with a walking floor was, or something. You know, there's like these certain agricultural trucks I had to learn about. I love learning about all these different things. So we worked with them for a number of years making this sugarcane rum, an agricole style rum. It was like the first one in the U.S. Now there are a few, thank goodness.
Yeah.
But of course, it was just like with the eau de vie. The American public had the slightest idea what an agricole rum was and didn't realize that it didn't taste like Bacardi. It did taste like, you know, it wasn't sweet. It did taste like Myers. It, you know, you didn't get butterscotch. You got green olives and truffles and earth. And there would be certain people who would open up a bottle and think it was the worst smell they had ever smelled in their entire life. And other people like me who think it's the best smell I've ever smelled in my entire life. But it was a really hard customer service product because we would get such emails and phone calls. What are you doing? You're trying to poison me with this rum. It was wild. Unfortunately, we haven't made it in a while because it was difficult to get the cane. One day I hope to do it again.
Yeah. Is that, is that your favorite St. George product?
It is, actually. Yeah. That is my favorite St. George product. The agricole, the unaged agricole rum. I like it better than the aged even.
And yeah. of things you all are currently producing, what rises to the top for you?
Rises. I like our single malt whiskey quite a bit. I do like our gins, but I like our single malt whiskey. I like our spice pear liqueur. I like everything, actually. There isn't anything I don't like. I'm trying to think. I like our green chili vodka. No, I don't think we bring out anything we don't like. And I think that if there was something I didn't like at the beginning, like I wasn't a huge licorice fan, so it took me a while to like absinthe, I like it now.
Okay.
So, yeah. Yeah, I do like a lot of stuff.
So shifting gears now just to, you're a board member of ACSA now. Tell me a little bit about your decision to run last year, and you know, just a little bit about what your experience has been like so far.
Well, I've been in this industry a lot longer than almost every other craft distiller that's active right now. And I do have all the background administratively, because I did everything. You know, I've done, except for distilling, I've done everything in a distillery. And I've gotten very involved with a lot of the compliance aspects, partly from having been through some intense audits from the TTB and the state. We were the poster child audit for the TTB back in 2009. They were there for 3 months on site auditing us. So I learned a lot, and there came a point, well, Margie Lerman reached out to me and asked me to run. And I was hesitant because I wasn't sure if I had the energy or, you know, the time to put into it because I'm doing so much at work. But I think the industry has gotten to a point now where it's time for some sort of senior voices to be there to provide some guidance and some oversight. It's been fun for everybody to sort of just be exploring a brand new industry and going in every different direction and sort of the Wild West. But it doesn't hurt to have some of us who have been through the ringer already, and maybe the voice of reason, or could just provide some mentorship and guidance. So that's why I decided to run. I thought it's time. I'm probably not going to be at St. George more than another couple of years. I'm going to be 68 this year, so you know, I don't want to work forever. But I thought, okay, time to get back a little bit. And luckily, I met Courtney McKee at the New Orleans conference, and she invited me to be co-chair of the education committee, which is the perfect place for me, because I think you could tell from our conversation that I do love educating people. I do love information. I do love sharing information. So it's been great. I've been working with Amber Pollock and Courtney, and I are co-tri-chairs.
Tri-chairs,
yeah. Of the education committee, and we have some ambitious goals for taking the ACSA and education to another level, making it really quite professional and making sure that we provide really solid, helpful information and not just sort of any kind, not vague stuff and not just feel good stuff, but things that are useful to everybody. And sometimes things that may be guardrails or guidelines to help people navigate in the industry.
So along the lines of, you know, guidance and education, what's your biggest piece of advice to somebody that might be listening right now that is just in the beginning phases of thinking about starting a distillery?
Well, one of my biggest pieces of advice might be that just because you think something should be okay to do doesn't mean it's legal to do it. And often that the laws have nothing to do with common sense, but you still have to follow them. And so you better find out what they are before you start just leaping in. Other than that, other things I would suggest, make sure you have enough money when you start, because it's expensive and you always have to grow, which means you always have to throw more money into it. It's a never ending process. And make sure you love it. Make sure you really are enjoying what you're doing and you're not in it just to make money, that you're doing it because it fulfills some passion of yours and it gives you joy. That's what I would advise.
That's our program for today. Thanks again to Lucy Farber for joining us. You can learn more about St. George at stgeorgespirits.com. We'll be back soon. Until then, thanks for listening, and cheers.